Blog Talk Radio.
Assalamu alaikum. This is Your Health is Your Wealth with your host, Rashad Sunni El-Amin. And as you all know, I'm a holistic educator and doctor of naturopathy, dealing with herbs, foods, diet, healing, reversing conditions. I want to thank you all for tuning in today. As we all know, I'm on Thursdays at 7 o'clock, and I always like to thank Imam Alfred Muhammad, who allows me this spot every Thursday at 7 o'clock, and he's the host of Religion Means Alive. And I want to thank you all for tuning in, and I pray that all of you had a good week, and I hope that you have your family members to tune in, and your neighbors to tell your neighbors or your coworkers about this program so they can learn some things about health which will benefit them. Before we start, I always like to mention, because Imam Alfred asked me to, mention that this program always needs support. It takes money to keep this program going on. This is a 7-day-a-week program. With Religion Means Alive, 6 days, and Your Health is Your Wealth, 1 day. Now, he asked me to inform you that you can send donations, all who can, if you can, to Alfred Muhammad, M-U-H-A-M-M-A-D, 817 Jackson Avenue, Linden, New Jersey, L-I-N-D-E-N, 07036. He accepts all money orders and checks, and it helps keep this program alive. He also has another funding program called GoFundMe, Alfred Muhammad Prostate. GoFundMe, Alfred Muhammad Prostate. And you can also send money to that same address, or you can go online, whichever way, but that's the way you go, to the GoFundMe Alfred Muhammad Prostate on computer. So, again, I thank you all for tuning in, and we're going to continue from a couple weeks ago. We did something on a doctor who wrote a book called Confessions of a Medical Heretic. And we discussed how the hospitals, of course, do a lot of unnecessary procedures and testing that's costing the public a lot of money. And believe me, he was very thorough. He had to confess the truth. Now, this doctor is Dr. Robert S. Mendelson. The book is called Confessions of a Medical Heretic. And Dr. Mendelson, as you know, has he had a program that was nationally syndicated at one time called The People's Doctor. And he was the national director of Project Head Start and chairman of the Medical Licensure Committee for the state of Illinois. Among the many faculty and hospital posts he held, he was an associate professor at the University of Illinois Medical School and a director of Chicago's Michael Reese Hospital. And his other books include Male Practice, How Doctors Manipulate Women, and How to Raise a Healthy Child in Spite of Your Doctor. So this man was a medically trained doctor, but he felt that he had to confess the truth about what goes on in these hospitals. And I tell you, in reading this book, it was so thorough. It was so thorough. Now, before I start, I meant to say, and forgive me, my Muslim brothers and sisters who are fasting this month, Ramadan Mubarak. I know many of you are out there fasting, This is the month of Ramadan, and the fasting is a beautiful time of the year. The month of Ramadan is a beautiful time of the year when we do the fast, because of the cleansing of the mind, the body, and the spirit, and the renewal of life. And believe me, it's like the new spirit you gain after you do this fast, and the rewards you get for it. So I just want to, again, thank you all, and I pray that your fast be successful and be accepted by Allah. And there's many non-Muslims who also, along with Muslims, that fast also. And also for you, I pray that your fast be successful and be accepted by God, because many are like the idea of the fast, and you see the benefits from it. And hopefully you will continue in that realm and share your results with your friends and neighbors, what you got out of it, you see. So it's a true blessing. So again, Ramadan Mubarak to everybody who's fasting, and even myself, of course, I am fasting also. And I just want to say that this is my favorite time of the year. Okay, now, let's look and continue from our last discussion on the Confessions of a Medical Heretic. Now, we left off where we were dealing with childbirth in hospitals, okay? Now, we know before hospitals, women had childbirth at home. They had no complications. They would at home deliver their children. They had a midwife or something, and they would deliver it naturally without what you go through in these hospitals. But let's look at this. He says here, the first major intrusion into childbirth was the introduction of forceps, two sinister 16th century barber surgeons. The Chamberlain brothers always carried a huge wooden box into the delivery room. They sent everyone else out of the room and blindfolded the mother in labor before opening the box. It wasn't until the 19th century that the contents of the box became widely known as obstetrical forceps. Using forceps to extract the baby, whether or not the birth proceeds normally, was the first step towards turning labor and delivery into surgery. Not only that, and I'm not quoting now from the book, I'm going to say something. It's known that the way they deliver babies today, with a woman laying on her back, was something that King James came up with. You know, he was a pervert anyway. And he just wanted to look at the women in their nakedness delivering these babies and had them lying on their back, which doesn't make sense because the best way to deliver a baby is to squat. It makes the delivery easier. But this is more painful laying on your back. But this idea came with King James of England back in, I don't know, 1500, somewhere around there. Okay? So I'm just sharing that with you because they still use this system in hospitals. Okay, now, let's quote again from the book. The next step came as scientists became interested in the birthing process. Doctors began to compete with midwives, and as they won, the process came to be supervised by the male doctor rather than the female midwife. Now, why the male doctor? Why couldn't it be women there? You see, you got to look at this whole system. I told you, King James idea. Now, it wasn't long before childbirth moved from the home into the hospital. Why the hospital? This is a big money-making venture, brothers and sisters. Okay, let's quote from the book again. Where all the trappings and stage settings for treating it as a disease could be easily arranged. So, unquote. to be treated as a disease. Do you see where I'm coming from? These people are treating pregnancy or the delivery of a child as a disease. Does that make sense? I mean, what kind of backwards medicine is this that they practice? You see? Now, from the book again. Of course, when the male doctors took over childbirth, it did become a disease. Huh? The doctors did something the midwives never did. They went right from the autopsy labs where they were handling corpses to the maternity wards to attend births. Let me stop there. Did you hear that? Did you hear that? They came from the autopsy labs where they were handling corpses to maternity wards to attend births. That should give you a hint. You understand? This is some wicked stuff. But anyway, let's go to the book again. Maternal and infant death rates skyrocketed far beyond what it had been when midwives delivered babies, unquote. Do you hear that? It skyrocketed, huh? Infant death because of this modern procedure, you see. Back to the book. One courageous doctor, Ignaz Philip Semmelweis, pointed out the deadly connection and was hounded out of medicine and into an insane asylum for suggesting that doctors were the agents of disease. Once Semmelweis' suggestion that doctors wash their hands before attending a birth was adopted, maternal and infant mortality rates dropped, an event for which the profession predictably took credit. Now, here's, unquote, here's these people doing these deliveries, filthy hands. I mean, come on, my God, brothers and sisters. I tell you, this is just really sad. And here's a man trying to awaken these people, suggesting just a simple procedure of washing hands. Anyway, back to the book. Once it became possible to drug the mother into a state of helpless oblivion, the obstetrician could become even more powerful. Since the mother couldn't assist in delivery while unconscious, the forceps placed in the delivery room was assured. Sedated feet in stirrups, shaven, attached to an intravenous fluid bag and a battery of monitors, the woman in labor is set up so well for surgery, an operation had to be invented so the scene wouldn't go to waste. Enter the episiotomy. So routine is the surgical slicing of the perineum to widen the opening of the vagina that few women and even few doctors think twice about. Doctors claim that the surgical incision is straighter and simpler to repair than the tear that is likely to occur when the baby's head and shoulders are born. They fail to acknowledge that if the woman is not drugged silly and if she's properly coached by someone who knows what's going on and if she's prepared, then she will know how and when to push and not to push to ease the baby out. When the birth is a conscious, deliberate experience, the perineal tear can usually be avoided. After all, the vagina was made to stretch and allow a baby to pass through. Even if rearing does occur, even if tearing does occur, there's no evidence that the surgical incision heals better than a tear. Quite the contrary. He says, my experience demonstrates that tears heal better and with less discomfort than episiotomies. There is some feeling that the episiotomy may lead to a later lessening of sexual pleasure. Yes, that incision, brothers and sisters, that cut at the vagina may lead to the lessening of sexual pleasure. Now, this, I have to stop there. I mean, look at what we're dealing with here, ladies. I mean, they make it seem as midwifery now is a crime or something, and you shouldn't have babies at home. You shouldn't have them in the hospitals with these butchers. That's what I call them, a bunch of butchers, you understand. Many people have children right in the car, going to the hospital to have a delivery. And it's a good delivery, safe delivery, you understand. I mean, women know how to handle deliveries. They know how to help deliver the baby, wash them up and get rid of the afterbirth or whatever. They know how to take care of that, cut the umbilical cord. That's no big thing. Why do you have to make it a big event in that sense in a hospital? Okay, let's go back to the book. Obstetricians were not long satisfied by the minor surgery of the episiotomy. Okay, that's the cutting of the vagina. They had to have something more awesome and dangerous. After all, the delivery room setting only adds to the feeling that something terribly abnormal must be happening here. And such an abnormal process surely demands medical intervention. The more extreme, the better. And since the delivery room is really an operating room disguised by the simple addition of an incubator, what really should be going on here is a full-blown operation. Hence, the obstetrical sacrifice graduates beyond the simple mutilation of the episiotomy to the most sinister development of modern obstetrics, the epidemic of cesarean deliveries. Now, I'm going to stop there. I know many of you out there listening right now, ladies, have had cesareans. This is something these doctors came up with. They just got to make this hospital more of a surgical thing when it comes to delivering babies. You know, they got to make it more awesome. And I'm telling you, watch these doctors. These doctors, believe me, either ignorant or they see how they can make more money doing these procedures. Let's go. Fetal monitoring. Listening to the fetal heart, either through the mother's abdomen or most recently through electrodes screwed into the infant's scalp during labor, is the diagnostic sewing procedure that is reaping the harvest of cesarean section delivery. Whether or not the fetus is really in trouble, if the monitor says something is wrong, there's a rush to slice the mother open and remove the baby. Then the obstetrician can bask in all the limelight that comes with performing a miracle. After all, he snatched a life from the jaws of certain death or disablement. Studies of comparable deliveries show that cesarean deliveries occur 3 to 4 times more often in births attended by electronic fetal monitoring than in those monitored with a stethoscope. That's not so hard to understand. If the mother doesn't want the operation, all the obstetrician has to do is point to the distressed blips on the monitor screen. That's reality. What appears on the cathode ray tube, not what the woman feels and wants. A woman has plenty of other reasons not to want her delivery electronically monitored. In order to attach electrodes to the fetus's scalp, the bag of waters must be artificially broken. This results in an instant depression of the fetal heart rate. In one study, children whose birth was electronically monitored were 65% more likely to suffer behavioral or develop mental problems later in life. Let me stop there. Look at these children today. Huh? Look at the teenagers, and even some people in their 20s, who are delivered by cesarean birth. Is there a connection between the behavioral or developmental problems later in life because of that? I believe so. You see, this is not natural, brothers and sisters. You know, Western medicine, I feel for you. Western medicine is the worst medicine around, the worst treatments. Believe me, they've gotten away from the natural things, the things that doctors who were more holistic, who were more in tune with nature used to do. These people are nothing but a bunch of butchers as far as I'm concerned. Yes. Now, let me continue. Of course, what the woman feels and wants is secondary to what the obstetrician says must be. And that includes scheduling the delivery according to the doctor's convenience. In many hospitals, the induced 9-to-5 delivery has become the rule. Working only from his calculations of when the baby is due, which can be off by as much as 6 weeks, the doctor induces labor when he feels like it. Not when the baby is naturally ready to pass through the birth canal. A labor induced by the doctor can end up a cesarean delivery because a baby that's not ready to be born will naturally show more distress on fetal monitors, distress as being summoned prematurely. Fetal lung disease, failure of normal growth and development, and other mental and physical disabilities associated with premature birth are dangers of induced delivery. As many as 4% of the babies admitted to newborn intensive care nurseries come in after medically induced deliveries. Mothers, too, are more likely to end up in the intensive care ward after an induced delivery. Post-operative complications occur in half of all women who deliver by cesarean section. And the maternal death rate is 26 times higher than in women who deliver vaginally. I propose that we drop the term fetal monitoring and start calling it fatal monitoring. Let me stop there. Now, I hope your sisters are taking this in. I'm telling you, African-American sisters, be very careful when you go to those hospitals, because you're the main culprits when it comes to this. You're the main ones that they suggest a cesarean birth, cesarean section, or whatever. You understand? Listen, you tell them what you want. And you tell them, don't try to con me. I'm here, but I want this thing to be done naturally. I don't care about a tear. It'll heal. You see? And don't try to deliver this child before it's time. Let the time come and let it be birthed naturally. Okay, now, let's continue. I hope you all are getting something out of this, sisters especially. Now, he says, full-term, regular-sized babies delivered by cesarean section are also in danger of a serious lung condition known as hyaline membrane disease or respiratory distress syndrome. This poorly understood, sometimes fatal, and usually unresponsive to treatment condition was once found almost exclusively in premature infants. If a baby delivers normally, the compressing action of the uterus squeezes the chest and lungs as the baby emerges. The fluids and secretions that accumulate in the lungs are then propelled through the bronchial tubes and expelled through the mouth. This does not take place in cesarean babies. Let me stop there. You see the need for natural birth, sisters? Huh? These doctors know this. They're not ignorant. These are educated people. They know these things, but they take advantage of you. Go back. One study concluded that the incidence of this disease could be reduced at least 15% if obstetricians were more careful about cesarean deliveries. The same report stated that at least 6,000 of the estimated 40,000 cases of hyaline membrane disease could be prevented if doctors didn't induce delivery until the fetus was mature enough to lead a womb. Yet the rates of induced deliveries in cesarean sections are going up, not down. I can remember whenever a hospital's incidence of cesarean deliveries went above 4 or 5%, there was a full-scale investigation. The present level is around 25%, and there are no investigations at all. And in some hospitals, the rate is pushing 50%. How wicked. Excuse me. That's me there. You see? This is the kind of stuff it's just sad. It is sad how they're taking advantage of people like this. You see? You know, in other countries, especially third world countries, they don't go to the hospitals to do delivery. They do it right at home. And they're fine. And in better health. But they got us trapped in this system. You just go along with the program. Now, coronary bypass surgery enjoyed unbounded acceptance for the first 5 or 6 years. Everyone acted like the operation in which a blood vessel clogged by fat deposits is surgically bypassed was the answer to the catastrophic rate of death by heart attack in the United States. Now, wait a minute, my brothers and sisters. I skipped something there. Matter of fact, let me go here. Let me go forward. And let's get to something else. He says, greed plays a role in causing unnecessary surgery. And we're talking about hospitals here. Although I don't think the economic motive alone is enough to explain it, there's no doubt that if you eliminated all unnecessary surgery, most surgeons would go out of business. They'd have to look for honest work because the surgeon gets paid when he performs surgery on you, not when you're treated some other way. In prepaid group practices where surgeons are paid steady salary, not tied to how many operations they perform, hysterectomies and tonsillectomies occur only about one-third as often as in fee-for-service situations. Okay? So these guys, when they're getting paid as a fee, okay, then you start to see more hysterectomies and tonsillectomies and all this here. And another thing, you know, y'all better wake up about these hysterectomies, sisters. A lot of you get them because of fibroid tumors. And a lot of doctors are just lazy and don't want to do the long procedure and get rid of the fibroids. So what they do, they give you a hysterectomy and take everything out. And tonsillectomies, taking out the tonsils, all that can be avoided. That's nothing but inflammation. My daughter, I remember, she had tonsillitis a couple times. The doctor wanted to rush and take her tonsils out. I said, no. I told my daughter, don't even go for that. I said, let me tell you what to do. I got some herbs, some golden seal, and this, and it reduced inflammation. And she was good. About a year later, it popped up again. I said, don't go for the surgery. The doctor wanted to do it. I said, just do it again. Do the golden seal, get rid of inflammation. She started changing her diet, more vegetarian diet. Never had no problems no more. That's been years. Okay? So, as you know, tonsils are your first line of defense in your immunity. Yes. So you don't want to lose them. But these doctors tell you, they're not necessary. Well, if they're not necessary, why did God put it there? Oh, the appendix is not necessary. Well, if it's not necessary, why did God put it there? What's the use? Are you that ignorant? I thought you guys were scientists and doctors and educated people. But anyway, so much for that. Now, back to the book. He says, ignorance plays a part in a lot of unnecessary surgery, too. I don't mean ignorance on the part of the patients. If, for example, you eliminated all gynecological surgery that resulted from improper, outdated, and outright stupid obstetrical I'm getting tongue-tied here. Gynecological practice, there wouldn't be much gynecological surgery left. Doctors know full well, for instance, that women who experience menstrual irregularities are more prone to develop vaginal or cervical cancer if they take oral contraceptives. Let me stop there. You hear that? Let me repeat that. Doctors know full well, for instance, that women who experience menstrual irregularities are more prone to develop vaginal or cervical cancer if they take oral contraceptives. In fact, the risk for some of these women, depending on what caused their menstrual irregularities, is more than 10 times the already increased risk. Yet few doctors bother to find out who these women are before they put them on the pill. I know of one woman who was taking the pill for years, unadvised of the danger she was in. She had severe bleeding during her first period, an incident that marked her as someone who should not take the pill. Even when her checkup revealed via a pap smear that something irregular was going on, her gynecologist told her not to worry since she could always get a hysterectomy. Wow. Apparently, his motives were a mixture of greed and ignorance, because the next doctor she went to told her that if she didn't have a relatively minor surgical procedure right away, she would definitely need a hysterectomy within a few years. But even that minor operation could have been avoided had her doctor informed her of the danger she was in the moment she started taking the pill. Let me stop there. Now, sisters, that little pill is like an atom bomb in your body. It is so destructive. Now, you got to find better ways, either abstinence or some other natural way of avoiding getting pregnant if you don't want to get pregnant, you see. But this pill is dangerous. It causes a lot of complications. I have a lot of sisters tell me they're taking that pill. Well, they would tell me about certain problems they would have. And I would ask them, do you take birth control? Yes. And it seems like when I started taking the birth control, it's when all these things started happening. Then common sense should tell you to stop taking the birth control pill. You see? That's all you got to do. Yes. Now, let's go up here and I'm going to another topic here. I'm going to read this paragraph. And he said, the first surgery was religious, and 90% of the surgery performed today is also religious. The Jewish ritual circumcision, or bris, has a place in Jewish law and culture. The bris is performed on the eighth day of life by a trained mogul who uses the same technique that has withstood more than 4,000 years of use. 10 men stand by to make sure he does it right, too. Modern medicine's routine circumcision, however, takes place on the first or second day of life, when blood loss can be especially dangerous. It's performed by a surgeon or an intern or a medical student using the latest technique. When the bris ceremony includes pouring some wine in the infant's mouth, no anesthetic at all is used in modern medicine's ritual. So these babies in the modern medicine's ritual suffer more on their circumcision the first or second day, as opposed to the Jewish ritual circumcision, which takes place on the eighth day, and they have 10 men stand by to make sure that he does it right. And then he says, routine circumcision of all males makes no sense outside of a religious framework. A circumcision is an operation, and its dangers are not inconsiderable. It's not altogether rare for a surgeon to get smart and use cautery instead of a knife to slip and burn off most of the penis. Ah, boy. Anyway, let me quote now from another page in this book. Now, let me pause here. This is Your Health is Your Wealth with your host, Rashad Suni El-Amin. And as you know, we're on every Thursday, 7 o'clock. And again, I want to pause and mention that Imam Alfred Muhammad from Religion Means Alive asked you all to send in whatever donations you can to keep this program alive. It takes money to keep this program alive. He has it 7 days a week. And you can send all your donations to Alfred Muhammad, M-U-H-A-M-M-A-D, 817 Jackson Avenue, Linden, New Jersey. Linden is L-I-N-D-E-N, New Jersey, 07036. And he also has the gold Fund Me Alfred Muhammad Prostate that you can also donate to. So please, brothers and sisters, keep that in mind. I meant to pause a while ago, but I just got caught up in this book, sharing this information with you. I totally forgot. Okay, let's go back. Quote from this book. This is what the doctor's saying. And for you, those who came in late, I'm quoting from a book called Confessions of a Medical Heretic. Dr. Robert S. Mendelsohn, who's a medical doctor, who exposed what goes on in the hospital, the unnecessary surgeries and procedures that a lot of you are victims of, you see? And he was the director of Chicago's Michael Reese Hospital, and also he was associate professor at the University of Illinois Medical School. Okay? Now, this book was written in 1979, but it's still valid today with what goes on in the hospital. Now, let me quote from the book again. He says, "You should start asking questions the moment the doctor mentions surgery. What is this operation supposed to accomplish? How does it do it? What will happen if I don't have surgery? Are there any alternatives to surgery? What are the chances the operation will not succeed in what it's supposed to do?" After you've obtained your doctor's answers, you should check out everything he says on your own. Chances are good that you will find conflicting information if you dig deep enough. That's the idea. Let me stop there. Huh? Check it out for yourself. Do your own investigation, brothers and sisters. Don't take these doctors' word as gospel. Okay? These people are in it for the money. They will rush you to surgery because they need that money. You understand? They got to keep up with the latest bends. They want to keep their swimming pool full every year with waters. They have the big parties in their backyard, have all these great vacations off your misery. Do you understand? Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that all doctors are like that. No. I'll say the best medicine they have, I always say this, is emergency medicine. When you have been in an accident, when you have been going through some kind of trauma, yes, I suggest you go to the hospital. But when it comes to those other complications, do your investigation. Don't take nobody's word. They always tell you second opinion. You might need about five opinions. You got to find an honest doctor. Do you understand, brothers and sisters? Very important. Nobody's word as gospel. Okay? Let's continue. And I read another section here. He says, get a second opinion. Don't go to a doctor in the same group practice or even to one on the same hospital staff. You may have to go out of town to reach a really independent doctor. You should ask the second doctor the very same questions that you asked the first. If you get two widely different opinions, you should first go back to the original doctor and confront him with the information. That still may not resolve the differences to your satisfaction. In that case, ask your general practitioner to hold an old-fashioned consultation at which all doctors are present with you. Now, this is advice from an honorable, honest doctor. Now, you should take heed of that. Brothers and sisters, you should actually take heed of that. Very important, you see? And a lot of people just fail to get second opinions because these doctors scare them into surgery, you see? got to be very careful, brothers and sisters. Now, let's move on. I want to... He says also, okay, let's go here. He said, again, you start to pick a surgeon by asking questions. You should talk to several surgeons and ask each and every one, how many times have you done this operation? What's your batting average? How many of the operations have been successful? How many haven't? What's your rate of complications? What is the death rate from this operation? How many of your patients have died during or shortly after this operation? Can you refer me to some of your patients who had this operation? Would they be willing to talk to me? And then he says, my favorite question to ask a surgeon is, if you were out of town when the operation was performed, who would you recommend for the operation? A variation of that is, if you needed the operation, doctor, who would you go to? You see? Oh, my God, brothers and sisters. This is something. Now, I want to, and we only got a few more minutes, so I'm trying to be done by 8 o'clock. But I am fasting, and I want to get ready to cook a little something for my wife, because she's coming home from work. And this way, you know, we'll be ready to break our fast by around 8:30. Now, let's see. What else can we discuss from this book? There's so much information in here, brothers and sisters. You need to get this book. You need to get this book. This book is thorough. This book is thorough. Believe me. Once you start reading this, you'll see that that you will have a whole different opinion of the hospital and doctors. Now, let me quote again. I'm going to probably make this the last of what I have to say this evening. And then next week, God willing, we're going to continue from this book, because I want to cover as much as possible. I got certain sections marked off because you need to know this stuff. I'm trying to make you aware. You see? I know you're sitting there, oh, I have a good doctor. I have no problem with my doctor. I do everything he says for me to do. He's very good. Yeah, I heard that too. And I've seen people fall dead. Anyway, let's go on. Now, he says, oh boy, and this chapter is called The Temple of the Doom. Says there's plenty to be afraid of. The God that resides in the temple of modern medicine is death. Says there are germs in hospitals that you can't get anywhere else in town. Not only because hospitals are such dirty places, but because of modern medicine's fetish for ritual purification. Now, that appears to be a contradictory statement, but it's not. Hospitals aren't kept anywhere near as clean as they should be. Housekeeping staffs are generally smaller than necessary. Whenever you have an overworked staff, the tendency is for only the obvious jobs to get done. And not that carefully either. So what you're liable to find if you look closely is dust and dirt in corners and other out-of-the-way places. Hospital dust and dirt isn't the kind of dust and dirt you find anywhere. What else can you find all in one building? Animal and vegetable waste from food preparation, rubbish and trash, biological waste from diagnostic medicine, surgical, autopsy, and wound dressing activities, bandages, discarded tissues from surgery and autopsy, sputum, placentas, organs, amputated limbs, sacrificed research animals, disposable diapers and underpads, catheters, soap, bodily secretions, cups, masks, swabs, sanitary napkins, plastic casts, syringes, and fecal material. All this goes down the same chute, collected and thrown by the same people, people who have access to patients, bedrooms, and operating rooms, as well as the kitchen, laboratories, and morgue. Wow. In one hospital, it was discovered that stretchers used to transport patients also were used to carry cadavers. That's bad enough, but these stretchers still bore the residue from their prior grim journeys in the same hospital, which, by the way, is a large public hospital in Washington, D.C. Organic residue and fecal material were also found in found in emergency room floors and working areas in the morgue. In patients' rooms, soiled dressings, dirty shower stalls, hypodermic needles, and heavy accumulations of dust were found. Such discoveries don't shock me anymore, since I realize that these conditions are the rule rather than the exception. And what makes these situations even more dangerous are the hospital heating and air conditioning systems, which blow the dust and germs all over the hospital. Not to mention the plumbing system. Hospitals have more plumbing than any ordinary building. Besides the usual hot and cold water hospitals have, besides the usual hot and cold water, hospitals have chilled water, distilled water, vacuum systems, fluid suction systems, oxygen sprinkling systems for fire, most of which are inadequate, refrigerant recirculated cooling water, drainage systems, sewage systems, irrigation systems, all going through their walls and floors. Not only are the chances for accidental cross-connection enormous, but so are the chances that illegal connections will increase the dangers of cross-contamination. Wow. You really want to be in a hospital, brothers and sisters? And listen, all I can say is learn to take care of yourself naturally. Stop running to doctors for every little thing, okay, unless it's an emergency. Change your lifestyle. Change your eating habits. Change your thinking. And you will get better and you will avoid these hospitals. Now, in closing, I'm going to read this last paragraph, and then I'll continue next time. He says, modern medicine's fanatical devotion to purification ironically multiplies the dangers of creating a class of germs which are resistant to antibiotics. In Chapter 2, I talked about how the overuse of antibiotics gives rise to bacteria which are resistant to the drugs. What better breeding ground for these super germs could there be than a modern hospital where antibiotics flow like soup? Some bacteria even adapt to the point where they feed on the antibiotics. Then what happens, of course, is that the hospital staff becomes a walking culture dish for these germs. Since they're exposed to them every day, however, they aren't harmed by them. But that doesn't do you any good when the housekeeper or the nurse handles your bedding, your food, your clothes, and you. The priests of the temple, the doctors, are even worse spreaders of disease. Doctors neglect to wash their hands unless it's before the sacrament of surgery, where it's part of the ritual. Usually they casually go from sick patient, handling tongue depressors, syringes, and various parts of the patients. yet they seem to feel that there's something uniquely clean about themselves, and they don't wash their hands in between. Doctors also have great confidence in caps and masks and rubber gloves, none of which deserves any confidence at all. Masks become so contaminated after just 10 minutes that they serve as bacterial cultures rather than shields. And rubber gloves often are contaminated too. Lastly, the white robe may have been sitting on the shelf for months. There's no guarantee that the white robe they make me put on is any cleaner than my suit. In fact, there's evidence to the contrary that the white robe may have been sitting on a shelf for months. How do they know it was properly laundered? Especially since it was no doubt thrown into the same tub as soiled sheets, pillowcases, and operating room linens. Just because it's white doesn't mean it's clean. The same goes for the bedding. The linens may be washed, but the mattresses and pillows are not. Overall, your chances of getting an infection in the hospital are about 1 in 20. That's a conservative estimate. Half of the infections in hospitals are caused by contaminated medical devices such as catheters and intravenous equipment. Before the explosion and the use of these devices, around 1965, device-related infections were virtually non-existent. You see? Now, I'm going to stop there because I'm finished for this evening. I will continue next time, brothers and sisters. I just want to say, be careful. You got to learn how to ask questions. Don't be scared to ask doctors questions. Let them get mad at you. But it's your body, you see? And I'm sure they would ask questions if they were the patient, you see? So be wise. Choose your doctors properly if you're going to use the doctor. But learn prevention, brothers and sisters. That's your best bet to keep you out of these hospitals or temples of doom. Again, I want to thank you. This is Rashad Suniel-Amin, the host of Your Health is Your Wealth, on every Thursday at 7 o'clock. And I want to also thank Imam Alpha Muhammad for allowing me this spot. And again, anybody who wants to send donations to keep this program alive, you send it to Alfred Muhammad, 817 Jackson Avenue, Linden, New Jersey, 07036. All you have a good night. And share this information with your brothers, your sisters, your family members, your neighbors, your coworkers. Have them tune in next time so they also can benefit from this program. Again, peace be on to you all. And to my brothers and sisters who are fasting during the month of Ramadan, may you have a successful Ramadan. Again, peace. Assalamu alaikum.